listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And we're going to have a lot of beyond in today's show. This is Writers' Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
Good afternoon, everyone. Enjoying this beautiful day, I hope. It's not too bad.
Not too bad. It's not true. Bad. This could is summer in Iowa, and yeah, it could be worse.
That's right.
It's going
okay. To each his own. Well,
subjective.
I'm not having to be out in the field doing anything, you see.
Right.
So
right.
If I were out in the field doing something, then it would be bad.
And our it's fairly cool here in the station. So
yeah, it's just right.
You know, mm-hmm. Yeah. If it's too hot where you are, come on down.
Right. Exactly.
So this is Writers' Voices, and this is the show where we talk about writing and books and things having to do with that. So what have you been reading lately, Caroline?
Not too much, actually.
That's because we've got all kinds of family and visitors.
Yeah,
and
right.
Things. And
right.
We have one of the visitors in the studio with us today that we'll be introducing in a little bit. But first, let me introduce our writer for this week. And this is someone whom, if you live here in Fairfield, you know, I know some of our listeners are all around the world, but if you're here in Fairfield, I'm pretty sure you know today's guest. We have Rudy Wilson, who is a author of three novels, Red Truck, A Girl Named Jesus, and Sonia's Blue. He has been awarded many awards, writing awards. He taught at various colleges, and Rudy, you attended the Iowa City Writers' Workshop, is that correct?
Yes, I did, quite a while ago,
and
in 1930.
And you taught there also?
I taught there for a couple of years.
Wow.
As a graduate student.
And in his bio, he mentions that he's slightly insane.
I didn't really need to put that. The heat makes me crazy. I would rather it was 20 than 80. I can go out in a t-shirt at 20 and I'm refreshed.
Wow.
It hits 80, I panic. I suffocate. I don't like to use these terms, but it's a pitta thing or something.
Right, right.
Double
right.
Fire sign. Hot. I run hot, run hot.
Yeah.
Well, the humidity, obviously high humidity, makes it difficult for everyone because you don't get as much oxygen.
So I get to use your AC. That's why I like to go to mental hospitals or jail or wherever, because they have the
they
AC
have air conditioning,
and don't have to
yeah.
pay for it.
So, Rudy, do you write more in the wintertime?
That's a good one. I'm pretty just spontaneous. It was a pretty bleak winter for writing. That's a good one. I'm not very disciplined or have much of a routine, except when I'm on something. And I'm on something now I'm very excited about. So I'm writing every chance I get, morning and in the evenings.
Great.
In the middle of the day, I tend to do what I have to do, you know.
Cool. Well, before we get into that, because I know that's what we really want to talk about today, I would like to also introduce our other guest, Dan Isaacson, who was my father's college roommate and who is joining us today from an even hotter spot in the U.S. He's normally in Boca Raton, Florida, and he's spending part of his summer in Iowa, where it's nice and almost not as hot. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Dan.
Good afternoon, everybody.
And you've actually done some writing, quite a bit of writing in your lifetime as well, haven't
yes,
you?
Yes, yeah. When I was in high school, I wrote physics lab reports and got C's and D's. And my physics teacher suggested I start typing them. And after I started typing, the first one I got a B on and the next one I got an A on. So I was a committed typist. of course, there was no computers in those ancient days. I'm 80 years old, and there were no electric typewriters then either. I hated writing. I don't have a great imagination. But I discovered that at one point that I was pretty good at writing descriptions. So I ended up as a technical writer and wrote user manuals for hardware and software.
Wow. Well, that's a whole nother story, which we should probably do a whole show on just in and of itself, technical writing. But
Yeah. Really.
So, Rudy, let's hear what you... The last time you were on Writers' Voices, You had Red Truck coming out for a second time.
Third time.
And you also had a number of things coming, being published, short
book,
stories.
Sonya's Blue, a collection of short fiction, some novel excerpts, several stories. And then later that year, I had two short stories and two literary journals. So it was a pretty good year, 2010.
Yeah.
And I forget what happened. I blacked out until writing-wise for a while. But something that you just said about typing, I've been so frustrated, as George would say. That's a little private joke, George Harrison. So frustrated that I can't type. And I've taken typing. My mother was right. Learn to type. You'll never regret it. But
yeah.
I thought it was a sick girl thing to do or a sissy. So I, you know, and that was so stupid. And I do the two-finger thing. And as I get older, I'm running out of energy, the irritation of all the correcting I have to do and how I can't keep up with the images that are coming. I hand wrote a book a few years ago called House of Gizmo. It filled like four notebooks. It was a long book. Took me 3 years to type it in. But my friend, Richard Beamer, for example, he says you're far better when you type because you don't go off on all these languagey tangents. Because I love language almost more than story. Story's my weak point, really. And he says when you type, you don't seem to have what it takes to go, I don't have the energy to go way off. So I kind of keep it to he did, she said, they went. It's a little bit more minimal and I think more accessible.
So, but you prefer writing longhand?
Absolutely, because you can keep up,
yeah.
And you don't have to think about the mechanics. And,
yeah, Caroline, you've talked about this before too.
No, I prefer longhand as well. Yeah, it just comes quicker, easier.
I think it's mind and body. You're more the coordination. The thought goes right to the hand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no gap.
Right.
But typing, you're dealing with a machine, and
you have to stop and think what you're doing.
Of,
yeah.
And with a bad typist, there's a lot of disconnect. And
wow.
So I took a course at the high school, and, you know, I could do like 5 words a minute at first. But I was working on something at the time. And so I'd go to work on something, and it'd be the dog. And I was so mad that I just went back to my old style because I
right.
wanted to write it. And
right.
I lost the home keys.
So, Dan.
Yeah, I can add something to that. I type fairly well, and I've done a lot of typing in my life, and I find that I hate handwriting because as I'm writing, I find, oh, that word isn't good, so I've got to correct it, and then this word isn't good. Oh, I got to move that paragraph down over here, and you can't do that when you're writing, but if you're using a word processing program, it's easy to just move things around, so when I got started using word processing programs, I was a happy man.
Maybe I don't edit enough with my writing.
Well, you can always, when you enter it in the computer, that's when I edit, see.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm writing longhand, I make notes, circle things, make a big X, fix this, stuff like that. But imagine all the books, Tolstoy, all those, every book before like 1980 was handwritten, or typed with those little pieces of white out and all that. I mean, you want to change a page, you got to rewrite the entire book, really. And boy, we can move, do anything now. You can move 40 pages to the end and move it around. And computers are, of course, a great joy, but also a real headache. Because when they start messing up, you really are in trouble.
Well, yes.
I have like 5 backups of everything I've written, at least. And there's places you can back them up online, which are great, storage places for free.
Yes.
You can back up your stuff. You know.
I was talking to somebody yesterday, and I said if somebody in the world wants to really mess us up, they just have to take our computers down.
Well, if they all went down, Y2K, that's coming, of course. No, but that would have been.
I thought it already happened.
No, I remember I was in Vegas at midnight. At a casino with my mother. She lived out there. I used to love visiting her, and we got along. Well, that's when we really started getting along well, when we gambled, because we had we liked it.
Good.
And she, at midnight, her and I were there waiting for the whole casino to crash, you know, and nothing happened. Not one thing happened. Everybody cheered and went on losing money.
Well, do you think that the ease of editing on a computer means that we end up with a better end product or a lesser end product?
Well, I think that's a tough one. I mean, like I said, all the novels in the world, books have written, probably 99.9% were not edited on the computer. Are they better? In some ways, I think they are. They're so different. The style is so slow. You know, the introduction, you know, would be like the winter tree was this and that. Take 10 minutes to introduce the topic, and now it's just right into it, you know. They get right in it. I think editing is made, I don't know, that's a tough one. Can I go home and come back? I like it. It's a lot easier.
It is a lot easier.
You're more editing prone.
Yes.
To edit. Because you can do it so easily, you'll edit. And maybe later you wish you wouldn't have.
Well, one of the things, we've had a guest on who taught a writing process. And she was really, Daphne Gray Grant, I think was her name. And she was really big on the idea that you need to separate the writing and editing process. And so with computers, it's easy to mix them up. But that the first draft really should be stream of consciousness.
Absolutely.
Right. Don't edit. Turn off the editor in the mind.
Turn the sensor off. And particularly, and I really emphasize this, if I ever taught or just for myself, I'm writing something now and it's getting really frightening. My characters have never been so free, and they are doing horrible things. They really are. This is going to be a shocker. It's really raw and harsh. And I've never had a thing where I followed them around so closely and just watched them and wrote it down. And there's not an iota of editing. I mean, they could do the most horrific things fine because I edit it later. I don't think about it. I have to be completely free to let it all just, you know, and in acting and in anything. Or imagine Al Pacino. Remember when he was jumping around yelling Attica in that movie? Attica, and Justice for All Order. If he'd have come out and said, Attica, you know, it's just nothing. He just went for it.
Right.
And so I think no editing on the first draft.
Yeah, put it all down there.
Even if it's just awful, like, oh my God, why would they do terrible? Leave it. It might work a little bit later, you know.
Right. And of course, the problem is that, particularly with the ease of self-publishing now, you might end up with people who don't edit at all or don't edit enough.
Self-publishing, yeah, that worries me, the term. But it's good in that people deserve to publish. But now there's millions of writers. It used to be like 12. You know,
right.
Hemingway, Faulkner, Henry Miller, back in the day, there were like 10 or 15 writers. Now there's like 2 million authors.
Right.
Even if they wrote like an 800-page treatise on their bathtub, they're authors.
Yeah.
And it lowers the standards.
Well,
but everybody has a right to publish, you know.
Yeah. Everybody has a story.
Everybody definitely has many stories.
Yeah.
Now, Dan, as a reader, do you tend to avoid things that you can tell are self-published, or does it matter to you?
I usually don't look at self-published materials. I find most of my reading materials, I do a lot of political reading, I'm a political junkie, so I find stories and books by people that I am aware of, and otherwise most of what I read is commercially produced.
Yeah, and there's a lot of people complain about the publishing industry, you know, all the time, you know, it's like they, and I know you've had some experience. Reading.
I'm ready to complain.
Okay, let's hear your.
Well, just a little. I wrote the New Yorker story. They didn't really want it because Gordon Lish was in the news, and he was my editor at Alfred Knopf, which was my lucky day when they published my first book years ago.
Yeah.
And so I wrote a thing about him and about publishing, and they didn't publish it, but. It's almost like if you're not with a New York publisher or a big publisher, it's very difficult. My publisher, Ravenna Press, no offense to them, and I hope the editor of publisher is not listening. We've gone round and round. She seemingly does nothing. She wouldn't even answer questions about whether she did it something or not. Like I said, did you ask for NPR to review the red truck, like for a new generation, because they reviewed it in the 80s. And the new book they might want to review. You could at least ask them. Mm-hmm. And she wouldn't even tell me whether she even asked them or not. And I thought it would be stronger coming from her.
Yeah.
And I emailed him many times, never heard from him. But she didn't try to get reviews. She didn't market it. I'll give you a statistic which shows what small presses. And the red truck had great reviews. Sonya's Blue has award-winning stories in it, and it did well, too. And a year of the doing the best I could do, and evidently her best, we sold, I believe it was 82 books in a year. You know, Da Vinci Code sold 40,000 hardbacks in like 6 months. I made $82. And I'm not in it for the money, but I want to be read.
Yeah,
and 107,
yeah.
Probably like 40 were sold here, you know,
right,
or whatever.
Right.
So that's a little frustrating. In my new book, I'm going to push it to the New Yorker, to the New York Times, and they're going to say, this is the most shocking book ever written. And it's going to sell a million. It is a hardcore book. I won't tell you the title because I don't want other people to go, yeah, that's a good idea. It's a hardcore title. And it sort of has to do with generations of pain passed down. Many generations passed down good family values, whatever that means. I would interpret it, if nothing else, harmony or happiness, security. These are the people that go out and work and are productive and continue. And there are other families that hand down abuse, and in the harshest sense sometimes. And somehow this is what is happening in this book. And there's already been a couple of stabbings and a kidnapping. And there's plans for this girl to shoot her uncle. And she's going to shoot him. I'll give that away. He deserves to be shot. But there is light. And the whole book takes place in one night, all in darkness. And there is salvation somewhat at the end. There has to be.
And what do you think draws you to the dark, to writing about the dark side?
I don't want to get real. Certainly don't want to get in any kind of self pity or like, oh, I've had a difficult time, because I haven't. But my childhood was pretty rough, I would say, pretty scary. And I think I carried a lot of that with me, and I'm drawn to the dark. Even in movies, it seems more dramatic, more real to me. I'm not that big on comedies unless they're just really good. Because also, you can't have light unless you first have dark. And I like to see darkness move to light. Mm-hmm. I like the theory, the theme of salvation. And you really can't be saved if you're already perfect. You know, if it's already a light, lovely day, you're all fine all the time.
Yeah.
You can't. So you got to have,
the conflict.
Some conflict to resolve.
Right.
And this one, I don't know why it's so hard. I might lighten it up a little. It just started pouring out. Maybe it's my own shame, my own anger, my own rage coming out. Because I'm not blocking it. It's not, not going to be a happy song.
Well, as an observer of the world situation, as you are, of course, there's a lot of that in the world.
It's a tremendous amount. And abuse in families, I hate to dwell on it, but it's so common, and it's really a taboo topic. Family really is where the pain is. Rarely do we get into a big problem with the mailman. You know what I mean? Or bring him in the house and abuse him or tie him up or, you know, whatever,
yeah,
you can imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
But family is where the best and the worst.
Yeah.
And hopefully there's some kind of balance so we learn and we grow, we grow up and are healthy citizens.
But as you explore that transition, that makes your story.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Definitely. The ups and downs of it, the learning from it, mm-hmm. the pain of it, the learning from pain. And then there's moments of tenderness, which some moments of vulnerability, even in the abuser, and that causes you almost to love them more. You ever seen kind of a tough guy or a tough customer, you know, who's really kind of a difficult guy, and he might slip up or something, and there's a moment of vulnerability in his eyes. And in that moment, you connect, and it's almost like you love him. There's love then. You look at a lot of people with love, and they'll give you the finger, or they'll slug you. They're hard. A lot of people are very very tense, very unhappy, seems like. I don't know about this community. You walk down the street in New York City and you look at someone with love in your eyes, you might well end up on the pavement.
Now, I always assume that I hope you're wrong, because I've always felt that I travel safely in the world because I smile at everybody, and like who's going to attack somebody who's smiling at them, you know?
Beautiful. It's like I think you're probably more right than I am. Of course, I was in a Turkish prison for 5 years for a false hashish thing. It was in a, made a movie about it, Midnight Express.
That was
so
you?
Maybe I'm not happy about traveling abroad. I've never ever really had any fights, really. Or I've traveled extensively, and I don't know if I mean it that way so much.
Yeah.
But with strangers, maybe because you're a woman and you smile. I don't know.
Well, that's true. That's true. And
it's not a happy topic, so yeah. We don't need to dwell on it.
Well, when I, you know, many years ago when I was writing short stories, you know, when I was in your class, Rudy was one of my
good
first
stuff.
Writing teachers.
Good writer.
And I wrote some of the things that I wrote. I don't know if you ever saw the complete pieces, but I wrote some pretty dark things. And over the years, like, I would show them to people when I, like guys that I, like new boyfriends or something, I'd say, hey, you want to read what I wrote? And I don't know if I would do that again, because the reaction I got was like, they thought I was really scary because of the stuff I wrote.
Scary lady.
They're like,
scared them off.
That's you? You wrote that? And I'm like, well, I write this stuff so I don't have to live it.
It's interesting. You get it out.
So there is
a purging of writing, I think. And sometimes I think that's why writers feel a little bit empty after a day's work. And what Hemingway, I don't know who said it, but it's always good to leave your work when you're still feeling creative. Don't write that out. Don't run into emptiness and walk away, or you won't really want to go back. So it's good to quit for the day when you still have some juice to go.
Wow.
But I think it's a definite purging. I often feel, if I've written a lot, I'll feel kind of empty or disoriented. Maybe that's why a lot of authors drank. So many authors have the reputation of being alcoholic or drunks, and they said Faulkner would fall down the stairs all the time, and all these people. They fill themselves back up with something. Better to run or do some asanas, maybe.
Yeah, meditate.
Have a good lunch, you know. Yeah.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Rudy Wilson, author of Red Truck and Sonia's Blue, and our special second guest is Dan Isaacson, who was a technical writer in his pre-retirement life and also my dad's college roommate, and so that's why he's very special to me. And, we're having... Rudy, I wanted to ask you, you know, in conversation, you say you don't really like watching comedies and so forth unless they're really well done. In conversation, you're a very funny guy. Do you write as funny as you talk?
I've heard this so many times. I've been told that I'm funny, and the sad part of it is that I tend to, I think, make other people laugh. It may be a defense thing, but I don't seem to have the mechanism of laughter. Just to be real honest, I said that adult children of alcoholics have a difficult time having fun. I wish I laughed more, and maybe I should try more of these comedies. Light romantic comedies I just don't find funny. Richard Pryor, for example, I'll wake up in the middle of the night and laugh thinking about him. So some things are really hilarious. But there's nothing ever funny. I don't think I've ever written one funny line unless it was by mistake.
And
I apologize to those who have been traumatized.
I think somebody should follow you around and record some of the things you say. Well, I think your friend Richard did that.
We have 17 years of doing that with each other. And we have a movie which is near completion. We took a 5-year hiatus because he wanted to go. He did a lot of the Indian films and all that, and
right.
Marshy and with David Lynch. But we're getting back to it, and it's going to be pretty intense. There's some funny stuff in it, though.
Can you describe that film?
Well, I also feel I'm hogging the microphone.
No.
The film is called Rudy, which I like, I guess. But it was originally, years ago, we were going to make a movie out of The Red Truck.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, let's just sit down and do page at a time. He goes, oh, you can't do it like that. And I did that recently. I wrote a script on The Red Truck, and I did it page at a time. But it is difficult, because you'll have something on page one that connects with something on page 12. And so you need to untangle the whole thing. And it was tedious, but it's done. But what we did was we finally decided we couldn't do it. So it's really about two guys who wanted to make a movie and couldn't. And there's a point where it is Richard starts laughing, falls down laughing literally out of his chair. But when he hits him, both of us, that we can't do it. But meanwhile, we've got all this footage of our personal lives over a 20-year period. And so there's snatches, pieces from the book, little scenes that we might have done, discussions of it, and our lives. Him from West Side Story days, footage. Him recently, what he does, him following me around. Really strange things. He was there at every emotional moment that mm-hmm. you can imagine that I've been through. Somehow he was there filming. I mean, weeping, freaking out, miserable, angry, laughing, whatever, crying. He was there. And or riding my bike, he'd be behind me, filming the shadow. I remember that one scene. And the way he edits is we have like 40 hours or more, and it's like he'll pick that, and he'll go, let's think about putting that with this. So it's not scripted. We just sort of put it together like a jigsaw puzzle.
Wow. So when is this going to be released?
Oh, well, release. He likes to tease me intensely. Whenever I talk about release or film festivals or, hey, let's get an Oscar, he's like, oh, Rudy, we're not talking Hollywood. We might not even release it at all. And that's frustrating to hear. I go, what do you mean? He'll go, oh, no, we'll do something. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. We'll probably, I don't know when. If it gets, let's say it was finished in the next 6 months, we'd have to really, you know, tighten up all the edges and maybe put it in film festivals.
Yeah.
Or some indie, IFC or an independent film company, Fox
right.
Searchlight or something.
Right.
I would hope. That'd be fun, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah.
It would be.
Yeah.
You're in it.
I'm in it?
Oh, yeah.
How am I in it?
I forget, but you're in it.
Well, then you really have to see this.
Yeah, now you're committed.
Now I am.
No, there are a fair few people that are in it, of course.
Of course, yeah.
Periphery or not periphery.
Right. Yeah. Wow. So, Rudy, I remember getting an email from you a couple months ago that I believe Red Truck was released on Kindle.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
How did that process work?
My publisher did pull that off, and evidently you have to apply or do something. I think I could be wrong. I think I read recently where there's 900,000 books on Kindle. So the problem, which I was meant to bring up earlier and spaced it out about small presses, is marketing.
Right.
Like Random House will market it for you or put you on a book tour. Small press, there's no money. So there's no book tour. There's nothing. You have to try to market it off the cuff. And what was the question again?
Kindle, getting on
Kindle. It's great. I'm so happy. And I got an email 3 days ago. She said, you've sold one book, $4.99, and she gets half because she set it up. So that's $2. And again, it's just an illustration because nobody knows that it's there.
Right.
You could have the greatest thing in the world. I have, for example, a T-shirt I designed. It's been online. It's on a website. It's been there for 5-6 years. I've sold, I think, two. Because nobody knows they exist.
Right, yeah.
Marketing is a real skill. You know, these guys have marketing degrees. You need a PR company. They all cost money.
Yeah.
One of them contacted me, and I was kidding around. Tom, well, what's this going to cost? A few $100s. And they thought that was pretty funny. They said, well, we'll need $5,000 up front just to start.
Wow.
So how do you market it? You got to do something flamboyant or a lot of radio, a lot of press releases?
Well, that's the difficult thing. And that's part of what has really changed about publishing in the last 20 or 30 years. Because you say the big firms will market you, but only if you're at the top of their list. They aren't marketing their mid-list anymore. They're leaving that up to the writers, too. And they will, and part of what they look for when they decide to publish a book, and I'm sure this is true with small presses as well, is they're not just looking at the quality of the book. They're looking at the platform that the writer brings with them. That means how many email connections do you have, how many followers on Twitter, how many friends on Facebook, how many do you go to conferences where your book would be for sale? You know, how many books are you going to be able to sell because of what you do personally? And that's a big part of the decision. Particularly, it's even more so in nonfiction than in fiction, but I think it's true in fiction as well.
Kind of sad, really. It's like your marketability.
Right, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Like if you're a fantastic actress, but let's say you don't look like Keira Knightley, then you're out. Yeah. They'll relegate you to a third-rate role or something.
Yeah.
So who's getting published? I'm not reading a lot of new. I did discover a relatively new author. Her name is Elizabeth Brundage. She went to the Iowa Workshop, won a Michener Award. We have a lot of similarities. She's with Viking and Plume, New York Presses, and she's doing pretty well. And her writing is good, but she does a little bit of cheating, in my opinion. She'll write lines like, "She laughed nervously."
Oh.
"He ran up the stairs quickly." See, I just can't allow, I can't write, I will not write that.
No.
I want to see how that exact character, who is unique, we're all unique. It doesn't have to be a long thing, but the way his shoes look, or if he skips a step, or if he trips, or something, he drops a book on the way up the stairs, or what does it mean to laugh nervously for you? You laugh nervously differently than I do.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see even a half, you know, a few words showing that, some originality. She pulls that off a little too much, but her stories are very captivating. She's a real storyteller and kind of a bit of a mystery teller. So I've read her last two books. And
well, that's, like you mentioned, there's story and then there's writing, and they don't necessarily go hand in hand in the same authors. For example, I find Grisham's stories to be gripping, and his writing is really very mundane. You know, there's nothing really special about it.
Yeah. I couldn't put it down. I mean, it is a fascinating novel, but it was about 10th grade level of writing.
Well, I think if you're going to write a blockbuster, that's probably what you have to aim for.
Oh, I'm going to have to. I'm not saying I'm good with language, but I might need a little brain operation anyway, so I might ask him to minimize the language sentence. You know, he ran quickly around the corner, and, you know, he picked up the .45 and blasted the blonde chick. It was a classic line I learned. Someone said in the workshop, I forget what it was, "The blonde opened the door," or something like that. It's like, that's a classic line that everybody's used, and it's so, you just can't use it, you know, again and again.
Yeah.
But they do.
Well, I just read, I recently picked up an issue of Poets and Writers magazine, which I hadn't ever really looked at before, and I thought it was fairly good. And this issue was about agents, and they had an interview with, they had four different agents who had gotten new writers their first contracts with fairly large presses, and how they went about it, how they did it, and you know why an agent can help. And the main thing that an agent, it sounds like, brings to the table is contacts. And if they are enthusiastic about your work, it's a filter for the editors. You know, that they're getting pitched by so many writers, so they're getting so many things.
Yeah.
And but if an agent has filtered out and said, "Here's the one I really like," then they're more apt to take it seriously. So, Rudy, have you ever worked with an agent?
I was so fortunate. I was at the Iowa Writers Workshop, and the way that works is you're up, meaning your work is reviewed twice a semester by the class. And supposedly it's real brutal and all that, but it never was. It was pretty kind. And you're not allowed to speak. They have copies. They've read your, studied your work. And in the last 10 minutes, you get to defend yourself. And one of the times I was up, an agent from New York was visiting and happened to sit in on our class. Mm-hmm. And there were several classes. And she didn't seem to say much, but I saw her later at a restaurant. We were both stood up by people we were going to meet. And we saw each other and kind of went, "Well, let's sit." And we got to talk, and then she said, "Yeah, I'll read some of your stuff." So she took me on. And that's exactly what it is, what you just said. she got it to Gordon Lish at Alfred Knopf, and they bought it right away. Never would have happened. Some agents are the same as publishers. If a certain editor, Swifty Lazar, he was more in the films, I think. I don't know if he was literary, but if he said yes, then it was in.
Mm.
Some agents are so respected that if they take it to a publisher, it's a done deal, basically.
Wow.
Well,
I wanted to mention when we talk about the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop that my mother, Caroline, met Dan Isaacson at the University of Iowa. They weren't in the Writers' Workshop, but they were both students there in the early 1950s, I'd say, mid-50s.
Yeah.
Mid-50s. And that is how, and then Dan introduced my mother to my father, and that is how my mother and father met.
So Iowa was quite the connection here.
Yes, yeah. It is.
I think many people fall in love at
university. It has changed so much up there. I mean, when I go up there, just, you know.
Dan, have you been up to the U of I campus lately?
No.
Oh, gosh.
Wow.
The quadrangle's still there. That's about it. The same, yeah. But it's quite a place. We went to... So last summer we went to the writers' workshop.
We went to the summer writing festival.
Oh, they had a reunion last summer too.
Oh, that's right.
75th reunion.
Yeah,
it was fun.
I skipped it.
It was fun.
Yeah.
A lot of people, you know, from all.
Yeah, and
over the place.
Actually, this week is the Iowa Book Festival in Iowa City, I wanted to mention that there's a lot of literary events going on up there
this week.
Yeah,
it really is quite the literary scene. I mean, Saul Bellow read at University of Iowa. And Nobel Prize winner. I mean, not recently. He's died, of course. But everybody has. Dylan Thomas read.
Mm.
And the story about him reading is funny. I was told by the head of the workshop when I was there. He's a good friend of mine, Jack Leggett, a great man. He said when Dylan Thomas came, he was so annoying. He literally fall down drunk most of the time. And he also literally chased women around the offices and outside. I mean, he was a complete wild man. But when he read, they just wept. They just broke everybody's heart. His reading was not the man. So in that way, I see it as a gift. People say, oh, you're gifted. It doesn't mean that you, like me, my ego, my brain, Rudy Wilson is not gifted. But the gift comes to you, thank God, from some higher power or whatever. And if you're smart or lucky, use your common sense, you write it down. Mm-hmm. And so Dylan Thomas might have, without the gift, would have just been a guy. He died at 39 of alcoholism. He probably would have had a pretty unfamous life. But he had the gift.
Yeah.
He could sway any audience, and obviously he's world famous, you know.
And he was receptive to the gift. You have to be receptive.
Receptive. Very interesting. Honest, open.
Mm-hmm.
Honesty is so important in any art. If you're not honest, what are you doing? You're writing what you think others want to see, like sitcoms. You can't be honest on a sitcom on ABC.
No.
I mean, it's not real. It's for light entertainment, and that's fine. But
even worse
really
is the
honest,
reality shows.
Reality shows, I guess they're honest.
I don't think so.
I saw a thing about Nick Nolte the other night called No Exit. He interviewed himself. He was in a white suit, and he would ask the questions, and it would cut to him looking disheveled and kind of like a wild man. It was an interesting thing, but he was so down to earth and real, and what the pain and torture he'd been through as a person trying to delve up these characters.
Mm.
At one point, he said this beautiful thing. He said this fear used to just come on him like smoke under a door. He said it would just wash. He was terrified, and he had a breakdown. And he said one day he finally just said, okay, just come on. And he just took it all on, and he said within minutes it went on by. He said it was nothing. And that was really something that I want to work on. And that's what people talk a lot about. If you can feel it, you can heal it. That whole thing. Feel it. Don't run from it.
Yeah,
and he
yeah.
had been, a lot of us run from it, and it gets worse if you resist it. But he's quite an honest actor, I think.
Yeah, I think so. And you can see it in his face.
Something that we haven't talked about is the new way of reaching people, the way that politicians are now raising money. They do it on the web, they do it on the internet, and they get tremendous number of small donations, which end up equaling, if not beating, the large donations they used to get, the single donations. And so if you're looking to sell something, a book or whatever, you put it on Facebook, you tell people on Facebook, you tell people on Twitter, you tell people on your emails, and it begins to get shared around.
Right.
And the word gets out.
But it can't, you can't just tell them once, you know. It
right.
You have to, like, yeah. I get some of these solicitations from politicians particularly, and, you know, I'll get them, like, every day from the same ones. And after a while it can get annoying, but after a while sometimes I donate, you know, and I don't donate on the first one or the second one, and sometimes on the 10th one I do. And so, yeah, but that's what, you know, what Rudy was saying, that's marketing, and that's a very different skill than writing. And, you know, do you as a writer want to be a marketer? And if you don't, you know, how do you, you know, maybe you partner up with somebody who has the marketing skills and say, I'll split the revenues with you.
There's a saying or understanding, I think. I have a friend, maybe a lot of you used to know, Trisha Klein.
She
lived here with the twins.
Yeah.
She had a straight job, and she quit one day and came home and said, I'm through working. I'm going to become a sculptor. She didn't know anything. She started doing, like, second grade level sculptures, little silly things. And over the years, she put in like 8 hours a day at this. She now sells pieces for $10,000.
Oh.
She's the head of the Woodstock Arts Council. I mean, she just did that. But they often say artists cannot market generally their own work. And I think she does have someone who is much more, whatever brain that is, part brain, who's much more practical and can do that. I had a comment on my Facebook, because I always have my books listed at the top, because people will put stuff and it'll push it down. So I delete and delete. And someone wrote me and said, you know, we've seen this so many times and we've just had it. This girl wrote me and she said, just get rid of it. We've one time, 10 times, but 200 times? We don't want to hear about these books anymore. And so, you know, it goes either way. But I would like to have the possibility of viral marketing. Like, if everybody on my Facebook list, maybe 500 people, if they would insist to write all of their people, and they would insist and go down the line, you could reach a million people in an hour.
Yeah.
But most people aren't going to take the trouble to do that. You know?
Right, right.
And so it's a challenge.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I'm up to it. I'm kind of laid back, and I'm not working that hard on marketing.
But you're writing.
I'm writing this new book, and it scares me.
When I invited you on the show, you mentioned that you had discovered something new, and that you wanted to talk about. And is it this way that you're writing? Is that what you were referring to?
I don't know what I meant by that. I don't know if I said that.
I don't know if it might not have been that exactly.
Maybe just working on something new. But it is. Well, there's been a bit of a breakthrough. I think there's less editing. When I said earlier I don't edit when I write, maybe I used to a little bit. This time I've never written where the characters took over as strongly.
I think that's
I'm literally chasing them to get with a microphone trying to hear what they say. And it's like, thank you. And I'm trying to get it down fast enough. And they are really, there's a woman in it that is really crazy, really tough, very angry. And every sentence has the F word in it, I think. And it's going to be harsh, and I don't know really why it's happening. There's going to be retribution. It's like almost like fathers to these generations that go down. And this has been a rough one, and a lot of them are going to get involved. The evil uncle and the brother, two brothers and a sister. At one point right now, one of the brothers has been knocked unconscious by the other brother and tied to a chair in an abandoned schoolhouse in Batavia. And the sister has stabbed both of them already.
Wow.
The older brother, lightly, because he wasn't involved. He had left the home. He was much older. He didn't know about the abuse.
This is dark.
It is dark, and she's very angry. And they're going to have to, I don't know what's going to happen.
Have you read The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo?
Shane Orne lent it to me, and it's on my list. Everything I'm reading right now is from her.
Well, there's some similarities. I mean, there's a lot of, in the first book, there's a situation with an abusive family situation, but it doesn't feel, you know, dark or horror. I mean, it's horrifying what's happening, but the main, like the lead characters, the main characters are trying to get over it. Like I said, there's light, there's resolution, there's...
Well, you have to like the characters. Yeah. I mean, if you don't like them, particularly as a writer, you need to like your characters. I remember a teacher at Iowa, she was great, Doris Grumbach, she said, there are boring people. There are boring characters, but don't write them in a boring way. Mm. So if there is darkness in this, but I don't want them to be horrible. They're not monsters. They're human beings who've had problems, and they're vulnerable, and there is tenderness, there is love. And it's going to work out one way or another, I assume.
I think one of the things that's perhaps different from the book I was referring to is that the bad guys in that novel, you don't feel any sympathy for them.
Oh.
They are really completely bad. Oh. Now, the good guys have a dark side, too. So there's you get the dark and the light in the same person in the hero and the heroine. But the bad guys are just like, completely out.
It's funny, it reminds me, I don't know why I think this, I have no filter, you know, but I said, James Cagney supposedly said, or they said about him, why he was so good at playing a bad guy. He said it's because bad guys do not think of themselves as bad guys. Just like if you rationalize robbing the Mighty Mart or the Pep Stop, you know, you would probably have some way of looking at it that, well, I had to, or I'm not really a thief, or I did it because I needed to get some food, or, you know, you don't think that I'm a bad person and I'm just going to do the, I'm evil. Maybe there are people that want to be that, but I think that's just a minimal thing. I don't think that's many. But he was a guy, an actor that could be a bad guy, but he was likable.
Yeah.
You know, because he didn't see himself as a bad guy.
Yeah,
I don't know. You know what I'm saying? So, but you're talking about a book with people that are truly bad. Yeah. They're going to get theirs, I bet.
Yeah, but it sounds like, yeah, they do. But in yours, it sounds like the heroine and
well,
hero, they're the bad guys are good too.
They're only bad in that they are hurt people. They're damaged. Hurt people, that's a cliche.
Yeah.
These are injured people, and they are hurting each other, really, and they're hurting other people, but that's why. And so you can see the hurt in them and the vulnerability in their craving for love and acceptance and a life away from this upbringing they've had and that they're still living in.
Our prisons are filled with abused children.
No doubt. I'm sure they are. Yeah.
Well, Rudy, we only have about 10 minutes, so I'd like to give you an opportunity to read a little bit from this short story.
Well, let's hear more from Dan and your mom. And
No, please, go ahead.
Yes, discuss like the Beatles or something.
So this is, tell us a little bit about the publication that this is in.
It's a literary journal out of New York, I believe. I've forgotten. It came out in late 2010 called Unsaid. It's supposed to be a pretty big deal. Let me see. They published a small excerpt from a novel I wrote. If I can find it, I had it marked. It's from a book I wrote, I have to admit, some time ago, called Shiny Apollaris.
And don't forget, we have to censor any language.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, this is not like that at all.
So you're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and we're going to hear a reading from Rudy Wilson.
Okay, this is just the beginning or a section of it. They took Shiny away from me. I never saw her again. It was because of what I did with her and to her once in the small world we made, and our mother died of it. Then there was just me left to think about for her from then on. Shiny cut her hand holding to the sharp wooden fence post when she saw me taken away. She watched me for a long time, and still she watches. I was her older brother, once good. Her, she was the best. She was my sister. I still see the little cut on her hand. It was like her colors, the red ones. She put all these separate red ones into a big crayon box together on her shelf, with her collection of elves, angels, fairies, a picture of Dad, and said, "Red colors, like the blood of her child's heart, of our one wrong heart that beat always together and still does." She stared at me one morning at the breakfast table. Her feet just touched the floor. I looked now to see, to remember. Her hands, I could see them both. One rested flat, curled some, now that I thought of it, there on the table. Her eyes glassed up. Her straight hair was cut, even, down to just below her chin. As she watched me, I put down my fork. I couldn't eat. I felt bad, but tender, like when there's a fever. Shiny cried about me. "What's the matter with you two?" our mother asked us. "I don't know," I said. "There's something here, something I see." "Tell me," she said. "What is it, Carl? Tell me." My mother leaned over to me. Shiny held her fork in the air in her thin hand. "A man," I said, "by himself, walking in the nighttime. He's not happy. He's sad." "Who is it?" she asked. "It's me," I told her. "It has to be me." Shiny yelled across the table to me. "Am I there? Am I there with you?" "No," I told her. "I don't know where you are." And then she had a lonely mouth. Me and Shiny, what we were, without then knowing what or even really when, and certainly never why.
Thank you, Rudy.
Thank you. I like Shiny.
Yeah. And that's a novel that you haven't published, right?
No, and it's come close many times. It's my favorite work. Mm. It's funny. Yeah.
So would you consider self-publishing that?
Yeah, well, I don't even know how to self-publish, but I would. I think maybe I will. It's not a bad idea. I might run home now and do it.
Yeah.
No, I guess we don't have time to discuss it. But
well, a little bit. You know, Lightning Source is the main firm that... I mean, there's a lot of different ways to self-publish, actually. You could use... There's some that are kind of hybrids of a publishing company and self-publishing. First World Publishing here in town is like that. They help you through the whole process. Then there's... If you go directly to Lightning Source, it's more of a do-it-yourself kind of thing. And one thing that I've always recommended for people when they're self-publishing is, if you can possibly afford it, is to hire a professional to do the book design cover, the book cover design, because that's...
I know what I want, but I couldn't know where to do it.
Yeah. And, of course, George Foster here in town is an award-winning, multiple award-winning book cover designer.
Excellent.
Yeah. And... Dan, you got some...
One thing about computers is some people are publishing, self-publishing, one at a time. And if somebody wants a copy, they will then put it into a PDF format and send it out. So you don't have to put a lot of money into it when you publish yourself.
Well, that's true.
That's published on demand.
Yeah, you can do print on demand, or you can do e-books.
Yep.
One at a time, you know, sell ebooks one at a time. Print on demand means that you're not buying 1,000 books. You're just, they're just printing one when someone orders. But the cost per copy is higher. So if you think there's a good chance you're going to sell 1,000 books, you would make more money by buying 1,000, doing a print run of 1,000. But if you didn't have the money to do that, you can do the print on demand. And I think you can get into print on demand for a couple $100.
Well, look into this.
Yeah.
This is a silly kind of problem. This is how old this book is. I hate to admit it. I wrote it in the 80s. It was my second book. When I transferred it from my Mac to a PC, I lost half of it.
Oh.
So I don't even have it digital.
So you'd
have to type a paper copy, so I'd have to retype the book.
Well, I think that you could probably get it scanned in.
That's an excellent idea, of course.
Yes. Yeah.
Looking for scanners. Give me a call. All right. That's a very good idea.
And I think there's even, if you can scan it into a PDF, then you can convert it to a Word or another format. It's a little tricky, but it can be done. So you don't have to type it all in.
Excellent.
So.
Yes, you can scan directly from a scanner into Word or WordPerfect.
Oh.
You don't have to go through PDF.
Oh, okay. All right.
And then you can edit it, the words that don't come out correctly, you edit those. And then you can put it in PDF later.
That's fantastic. I don't know, maybe you can help Rudy when we get off the air. We knew we had a reason for having our computer expert here today.
Very nice. Yeah. Nice meeting both of you.
Well, we're about to the end of our time. And Rudy, I just want to thank you again for filling in at the last minute like this. And
happy to do
I hope I can call on you again when I have a space.
I'm a talker. You know it. I can't help it.
I love talking to you.
Thank you.
I love talking to you.
And good luck with that new book, because it sounds most interesting.
Yeah.
And don't worry. It won't be too shocking.
Just the most shocking thing ever written.
Maybe. Yeah. If the New York Times said that, whoa.
Yeah.
You'd be in good shape.
You would be in good shape. And next week on Writer's Voices, we're talking with a former Fairfielder, John Rainey, who is a script consultant and script writer in Hollywood, and he's going to talk to us about script writing. So if you have an interest in
that,
be sure and tune in. And before we close for the day, do you have a quote for us,
Mom? Yes, I do. I love this. This was astronaut Alan Shepard, quoted in the Associated Press. It's a very sobering feeling to be up in space and realize that one's safety factor is determined by the lowest bidder on a government contract.
That's good.
So thank you, Rudy, and thank you, Dan. I hope you get to join us again on Writer's Voices. And we'll talk more about technical writing. And stay tuned now for Planet Earthwild. I'm not sure what James has in store for us, but I'm sure it will be fascinating. And see you next week on Writer's Voices.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writer's Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa. Thank you.